from where we left off, which was the start of the recording. Sorry, I didn't get it at the beginning, but we introduced our main question, which is how do newlyweds navigate conflicting monogamy? And I was curious to hear from the group if anyone had that experience.
This is Yoram. I think that every couple that gets married, even if they come from the same, if they're both Ashkenazi, for example, they probably bring from home different minhagim and different food, especially if some are, in our case, let's say my parents were Romanians and Nira's were Polish, Russian, so they have different foods. You really have to compromise, and some stuff you don't eat. Or you just change your habits. It's all a matter of compromising, just like anything else in a marriage, not just the food.
Okay, so great. So I think you made two points, Yoram, of importance. One is that this applies not only to halakhic areas, but to all areas of Jewish life and all areas of life in general, right? Even the ways you schedule your days and the foods that you eat and the lifestyle you conduct, but included in that is the food. And it
Yes,
sounds like you're
it's not just kitniot, for example, for Pesach. It's a lot more than that.
right, absolutely, right. The I mean, and then I think your solution really speaks to this, which is that if the solution is compromise, right, you have different minhagim, and the goal is to come to a synthesis, let's say, something that is kind of works for everybody, in the sense of compromise. So that might be one approach that one could take. Anyone else have experience with this that they're interested in sharing? Okay,
How
considering this
long to
is
wait
oh.
between, oh, sorry. I was going to
Please,
say, how
please.
long to wait between fleishigs and milchigs?
I think this is a very common example, right?
Yeah,
There's
that's
a huge
probably the
amount of
most
divergence.
classic. Yeah.
Yeah. So we got lucky. My wife and I both waited 6 hours. I mean, one might call us unlucky, but in this sense, we were lucky. And it can be a more complicated issue. I think people generally have a tendency to like going for the more lenient time when that comes up. So, but that's an interesting example because in some ways, I think that's an example where if everyone kind of kept their own minhag, it maybe wouldn't be as big a deal, let's say, as not being able to eat the same food. No, we can eat the same food, just I'll have ice cream for dessert and you'll have, fruit for dessert. And that wouldn't necessarily be the biggest deal. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the halakhic background. I'll share my screen, and if anyone's interested in looking at some of the sources, I'm more than happy to share after the fact. But let me just share my screen now to get started. So, if you would ask me, when was the first time this question was asked? I'm not sure what I would have said because I'm a little bit biased having done all the research. But I wouldn't have guessed as late as it is, right? A lot of halakhic questions sort of find their roots in very early sources, the Mishnah, the Gemara, early Rishonim. The first time this question is ever asked is in the 15th century. It was asked by to the Tashbetz, who's a North African Rishon in the 15th century, so the 1400s. And this is, as far as I can tell, the earliest record of families reporting diverse minhagim and trying to contend with that. It's possible that some families had diverse minhagim and nobody talked about it, but this is the first recorded instance. And I think it's quite late, which is itself a little bit interesting. As a historian, you could wonder, and I think hypothesize, that perhaps that has to do with the nature of intermarriage, not intermarriage with outside the Jewish people, but intermarriage among communities in among the Jewish people. And perhaps until fairly late in history, you didn't have much intermarriage. The idea of Ashkenazi marrying Sephardim, for example, which is one sort of typical instance of this phenomenon. And it becomes more common over time. So you, as you would expect, the halakhic issue becomes a little bit more common over time as it comes up. We'll see maybe another reason why the question doesn't come up in earlier generations when we get a little bit further on in some of the Makorot. But just for now to note that it's a fairly, relatively in halakhic history, recent question. So Tashbetz was asked this question. When you have different communities with different minhagim, and a husband of one community marries a wife from another, there's no So it's not a question that has to be grappled with. It's an obvious question, or at least the answer is obvious. The wife has to follow the husband's minhag. I think this as a shorthand for what people's sort of conventional wisdom is about this question is fairly accurate. I think people have this sort of conventional wisdom that wives adopt their husband's minhag when they get married. Now, his reasoning is very interesting. The ishto kegufo v'chol hadvarim. One, a man's wife is considered to be like his body for all halakhic matters. And therefore, v'niftarami kihilat beit avi. So what he seems to be describing, and he describes this in greater detail very shortly, is almost like a metaphysical transformation that happens when a woman gets married. And a man has his minhagim, he has his obligations, whatever they might be, and there are different kinds of minhagim that we're not going to get into today. And when a woman gets married, she becomes part of her husband, and his minhagim almost automatically become her minhagim as well, because she is one with him. And he considers this not only to be true, but to be obvious. He already said there's no doubt about it. And v'davar zeh milta d'pshitehi. It is simple. It is obvious and clear. The ein bo safek. And then he gives another reason, which seems to be a side factor. I'm not sure why he introduces this as a separate factor, but it's definitely not the same as isho kigufo, as the first reasoning is. Shelo yiyu shnayim b'subim al shulchan achad, chalukim b'isoteyam ha'asor lezeh, mutar lezeh. You can't have two people sitting at the same table and they can't eat each other's food. What's uttered to one is mutter to the other. If they happen to have some disagreement between them. So Tashbetz considers it obvious that a wife takes on her husband's minhagim, and he offers two explanations for this, and he'll bring a little bit of evidence shortly, but so far he offers two reasons. Reason number one is the ishto kigufo, that a wife becomes like the husband, and therefore automatically kind of adopts his minhagim. And the second reason is that we want to minimize the kind of unreasonableness of two people in the same family having different halachot. Right? I don't think he's talking, strictly speaking, about shalom bayit. Right? He doesn't use the word shalom. I think he's arguing it's almost like unreasonable. Like, can you imagine two people sitting at the same table and they're both Jewish and they're in the same family, but they have different halacha? Like, I think the idea is unintelligible. And those are the two motivations of Tashbetz in this piece. This, like I said before, is sort of the standard mainstream, like when people don't know anything about this topic, they know this, right? That this is the sort of basis, the basic default. He then brings a little bit of evidence to this effect. We'll summarize the evidence, and I'll skip to the English just for clarity's sake here. The only question is whether, if the woman is widowed, if she returns to her father's house like she was before she was married, or if she remains in her husband's house as she was before she was widowed. Meaning, obviously, while they're married, they'll keep the same minhagim, but if the husband passes away, does she go back to her parents' minhagim, or does she remain with her husband's minhagim? It seems that if she had children from him, she remains with her children regarding their obligations and communal enactments, their takanot. And if she has no children from him, she returns to her father's house. And the paradigm that he uses, the model from which he derives this law, is particularly instructive. He derives it from a halakha regarding truma. This is a piece of background. We should know that truma is food that only a kohen is allowed to consume. It's sort of the first tithe taken from produce, given to a Kohen. A Kohen can consume it, and members of a Kohen's household can consume it. So his wife, his children, if he has any slaves, they are also able to consume the Truma. And the model from Truma applies to Minhagim as well, according to the Torah. From the Torah, he brings the following evidence. The daughter of a Kohen who marries a Yisrael is invalidated from consuming Truma. If she is widowed, then if she has children, she remains invalidated. But if she does not have children, she returns to her father's house. Similarly, and this is the inverse case, the daughter of a Yisrael who marries a Kohen may consume Truma. If she is widowed, then if she has children, she consumes Truma because of her children. But if she doesn't have children, she may not consume Truma even if she is pregnant. Behold, we have learned from the Torah that a widow follows her children, whether they are boys or girls, and more importantly, that she follows her husband's familial status. And the reason I think this piece of evidence that the Tashbetz cites is so important is because it's evidence about ethics, meaning to say, according to Tashbetz, when a woman is married, she transforms to a different status. And to the point that food that would be prohibited to her becomes permitted to her as a result of her newfound status, having been transformed into the wife of a Kohen or the member of a Kohen's household. So I think that's one sort of interesting representation of this idea. And again, the earliest one and one that seems to have set a tenor, it happens to be, on a historical note, it's interesting that for the most part, later authorities who are dealing with this issue don't say, oh, well, the Tashbetz answered this question 500 years ago, and therefore we should all follow his answer, even though he's the first person to deal with it, and then it isn't really dealt with extensively for another several hundred years. Nonetheless, it seems that he's not being quoted as like the great authority on this matter. It seems to still be up for debate in later generations. It's worth noting just a little bit, very briefly, that we seem to have a little bit more evidence of this phenomenon of mixed marriages, especially as we go on later in history, without the halachic question coming up. So this is a passage in Hilchot Pesach, raising a sort of side issue. We're not going to get into the details of the issue, but we should just note the reality, being described. Vera'iti, I, meaning the author of this Sefer Berakhei Yosef, saw that the Rav Knesset HaGdolah and his works prohibited a person to eat rice and cheese and other foods on the last day of Pesach. The halakhot of all of those things on the last day of Pesach is beyond our issue right now. Pecha, in a situation, D'ira Yom Tov Achron B'Shabbos, Shalol L'Bashal B'Erev Shabbos. If the last day of Pesach is also Shabbos, we're going to prohibit you from eating certain foods that you might otherwise be allowed to eat on that day because we don't want you to cook those foods on the seventh day of Pesach when it's still Pesach completely, right, without any of the extra leniencies that might apply on the last day of Pesach. However, ach, in ishto ochelet otam hadvarim b'Pesach, let's say a man doesn't eat rice on Pesach, but his wife does eat rice on Pesach. So Berakhei Yosef says, well, if she eats rice on Pesach, then yicholah lebashel, she could cook rice on Pesach, because kevan she mevashalet beochalet bo bayom. She's allowed to cook it for herself. She could eat rice on her own, and then once she's cooking it anyway for herself, she could cook some for her husband to have the day after, because she's only stringent to not eat rice on day 7 of Pesach, but not on day 8 of Pesach. Right. So he sort of treats this reality as a given without challenging it. He doesn't say, hold on a second, how could it be that there's a woman who eats rice on Pesach, but her husband does not eat rice on Pesach? He takes that as a given in the background and then just tells you the ramifications of that, which is notable. Not everyone agrees with exactly what this means for us practically, but it's worth noting that this as a paradigm exists. Now we're going to move to modern perspectives on this issue, and we'll note immediately that modern perspectives are going to be a little bit different for several reasons. And we'll see it already in the beginning as we get to this first piece from Rav Moshe Feinstein on 20th century. We already moved 500 years in the past few minutes to 20th century New York. So, Rav Moshe Feinstein is being asked basically the same question. Hinei ish v'isha, shehem medinot chalukot, a man and a woman from different countries, right? He's talking about immigrant communities for the most part. So a man from Germany and his wife came from Hungary, or his wife came from Morocco. Yishlam minhagim chalukim, neged medina ha'achar l'hachmer u'l'hakar. They each have different minhagim, some more stringent, some more lenient. Vinisu Zalzo in New York, and they get married in New York. And New York is not incidental here. New York is very important because in New York, unlike in many European locales, in New York you have multiplicity of minhagim present on the ground, meaning a New Yorker doesn't have a distinctive minhag New York. So minhagim adayim chalukim midin shnei batedinim b'irach. The minhagim in New York are already diverse, right? As opposed to a person who was in Frankfurt, where the minhagim have been well-preserved for many centuries. In New York, everyone's an immigrant, and there are a variety of minhagim present in the city. So therefore, So we laid out four logical possibilities. Either they all preserve their own original minhagim, or they all adopt they each adopted stringencies of the other person's minhag. We sort of increase the level of stringency because we can't justify someone becoming more lenient. Or the wife takes her husband's minhagim, or the husband takes the wife. We have all four possibilities that he's willing to entertain at the outset. Hanachon l'ni'adati, the right answer, he says, that isha tzricha Linai keminagabal, bein lachum or bein lagula. A wife should adopt her husband's main hagin, just like the Tashbis. But Rav Moshe Feinstein goes in a different direction from the Tashbis and gives a completely different reason. Deha din minhag beholech mi makom lemakom, kishein da'at olach, or limkom harishon. No way keminag makom shabalasham, bein lachum or bein lagula. Let's unpack this for a second. There's a halacha that comes up in the Gemara and the Tzachim and other places about a person who moves cities. So a person is living in one city, and the city has a universal minhag. Everyone in Skokie does the following. Everyone in Skokie, let's say, waits 6 hours after meat for milk. And then you move out of Skokie, and you move out to LA. You want like the weather better, and you also like the fact that everyone in LA only waits 1 hour between meat and milk. So the halacha is, as Moshe Feinstein says, when you move to a new place and you're going to stay there permanently, you're not just a tourist, you're not a visitor, under those circumstances, you're allowed to adopt the new minhagim of the new location. And not only that, you're supposed to adopt those new minhagim. This becomes relevant when dealing with the question of 1 day of Yom Tov versus 2 days of Yom Tov, when it comes to, let's say, visiting as a tourist in Israel, for one of the Chagim, for Pesach, for Sukkot, do you keep 2 days or 1 day? So this, the same halacha sort of activated. So he invokes this halacha, and then he says, well, you have to understand what marriage is. Rav Moshe Feinstein here defines marriage as a woman joining her husband's household. A woman is considered to have entered her husband's household when she gets married. Because she has a biblical responsibility to be with her husband. This is the definition of marriage. The definition is that now the wife lives in her husband. And he brings a little bit of evidence for this. He brings two major halachot, which we'll summarize outside in the interest of time. The first halacha he brings is from a Gemara in Kiddushin about Kibud Av Ve'Em. The Gemara in Kiddushin says that both a husband and a wife have both a man and a woman have a responsibility of Kibud Av Ve'Em vis-a-vis their parents. However, a woman, when she gets married, according to the simple reading of the Gemara, we're not dealing with Kibud Av Ve'Em right now extensively, but a woman, when she gets married, no longer has the responsibility of Kibud Av Ve'Em to her parents, because according to the Gemara, she now has a responsibility to her husband, to be with her husband, and she's not able to go to her parents and offer them the kavod and the service that she is meant to. So from that, Rav Moshe Feinstein infers that a wife is supposed to stay in her husband's home. I don't think he's talking here, by the way, just to be clear, about being, you know, at home versus being out in the street, or, you know, being a stay-at-home mother versus being a student or a teacher or someone who's in the working world. I don't think he's dealing with this issue. I think he just means, where is your sort of home base? Your home base is with your husband. He also brings a second piece of evidence from the biblical language, the language of Tanakh, where it describes, specifically in the context of marriage and in two local contexts, that a woman who's married is considered to be in the house of her husband. So the first pasuk he quotes is, V'im beit isha nadara, in the context of nadarim, the pasuk says that if she makes a vow while in her husband's house, which is the definition of marriage, it's the way the pasuk describes marriage as being in her husband's house. And in the context of divorce, it says, Vishilchah mi beito, when a divorce happens, she is sent out of his house, implying that when she was married, she was in his house. So for Rav Moshe Feinstein, marriage is defined as a wife being in her husband's house. It's as though she moved to her husband's house. Well, if she moved to her husband's house, the minhagim of her husband's house apply to her, because when you move to a new location, you take on the new minhagim. What's worth noting in this context is that, unlike the Tashbates, who argued there was this like metaphysical change that happened with marriage, right? When you get married, Ishtu Kagufo, you're merged into the same sort of halachic being, and therefore all the minhagim apply. For Rav Moshe Feinstein, she hasn't changed essentially. She's just moved. She's a traveler. So she moves to her husband's house. She adopts those minhagim. But he comes to the same conclusion. And this is, like I said, sort of the default mainstream conclusion. Many people will tell you, if you ask them sort of without any context or without any individual details of an individual family, what should happen when people get married, a wife cheats on her husband's been hugging. Or now we've really seen three reasons, two in the Tashbates, one in Rav Moshe Feinstein. And, you know, for the record, we're providing Yosef rules this way. Rishon LeZalman Orbach seems to take this as the default. The Dayan Yitzhak Weiss assumes this as well. A lot of mainstream contemporary post-humanism. What we'll do for the rest of our time, which will be about 20 minutes, maybe a little bit less, will be to look at some contemporary presentations. Incidentally, not intentionally, but perhaps this is reflective of a different reality on the ground. Incidentally, they're all 20th century, 20th or 21st century Israeli authorities. It's possible that Israel being a factor here could, you know, impact some of their analyses. They're all going to be a little bit more, I don't think more nuanced. That implies that the earlier authorities aren't being thoughtful or sophisticated, but they're not as diehard in this directive, right? They're more open to various forms of compromise or various forms of middle position in these kinds of issues. So we'll take a look at a couple of those authorities now. Our first is Rav Chaim David Halevi. This is an article in a journal called Tchumen. Tchumen is a really nice journal. It is basically a journal of contemporary halacha. A lot of very important essays have been written there in various matters of contemporary halacha. I recently gave a shiur on lab-grown meat and whether lab-grown meat would be considered pariv or fleishigs, or whether you can make lab-grown pork and have it be kosher. And some of the earliest essays introducing that to the world of halacha were in this journal as well. So it's almost interesting to see this sort of not contemporary question, right? It's theoretically, it's been applicable for thousands of years. It's not dependent on new technology. But nonetheless, this contemporary question being quoted here by Rav Chaim David Halevi, the former chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, again, a 20th century Israeli authority. And he starts his analysis in the exact opposite way of the Tashbis, right? The Tashbis said, "In tafek, it's unambiguously clear that a wife takes on her husband in Hagim." The Rav Chaim David Halevi goes in the reverse direction. First and foremost, I'll read the English, but the Hebrew is available. "I will note that which, in my humble opinion, is exceedingly obvious, which is that a husband has no power to force his wife to change her familial practices and adopt his minhagim if the matter doesn't bother him at all. Meaning to say, by default, don't change your minhag. Right? Whatever minhag you have is the minhag you ought to keep." Right? And on one level, this seems, you know, like a fairly radical kind of approach. You know, women keep their own minhagim against husbands, right? If we're thinking about Purim coming up, you know, you think about Vashti defying Ahasuerus, you know, how crazy it is that she, you know, thinks for herself and does things for herself, and how that, you know, cuts against certain very conservative tendencies. But it's also a very conservative claim, meaning minhagim are very important. Being loyal to your halachic tradition and your familial tradition is incredibly valuable. And if you're going to be loyal to your halachic tradition, that means even when you get married, stay within your halachic tradition. So in some ways, it's actually a very conservative approach or kind of a lady is put forth. And so by default, don't change your minhagim unless it bothers, meaning if it impacts him, if it causes him some complication, then there's room to think about it. Just the opposite, he says, don't think that you should change. It seems to me that it would be better for every woman who is a member of a particular Eidah, a particular community, who marries a member of another Eidah, to continue all of her familial minhagim as long as it does not impact their married life. Right? So we can think all day about many minhagim that would not be relevant. Nusach HaTfila. For the most part, I don't really care what Nusach my wife does. Now, that could become a little bit more complicated when we're educating children and figuring out what Nusach should they say. Okay. But that's a personal practice right now, and she should, you know, totally keep her own minhag. It doesn't impact anything. How long you wait between meals could be another good example. Cooking in the kitchen is a little bit more complicated, and maybe that's already something that interferes between the two of them. Okay. sorry. Now, he engages with the Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument. I'm sorry, I see a question in the chat. Okay, no worries. Anyone has to head out, please feel free to do. Okay, so Rav Chaim David Halevi continues with Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument. He says, it's true that there is this halacha of moving from one place to another, holech mimakom lemakom, and that sounds like it should be relevant to marriage, but it's not relevant to marriage. Because what's the reason that a person who moves to a new community needs to adopt those new minhagim? Because of shalom, to prevent dispute, to prevent machloket, you have to have harmony within a given geographic locale, especially when that locale has their own firm minhagim. Right? If you're in New York and there are a million different minhagim floating around and no one knows what's what, so fine, it's okay if everyone's doing their own thing. But for the most part, if you're in a location where everyone's doing the same thing, then for you to be an outlier is a pretty big deal. But other Beit Shalom, when one moves to a new place, the rabbis were very strict because of their concern for conflict from machlokot. If they follow one person here and a different person there, and the person who moved publicly practices against the accepted practice, if I'm doing my own thing against what the minhag is, this would harm the local authorities and would certainly lead to a grave conflict. All of a sudden, you're questioning the local rabbi. Well, this new guy, he's being really makil on this question. Why are you being so machmir, rabbi? I don't want to listen to you. I want to listen to the other rabbis. And all of a sudden, you break down communal authority, and you need to use machloket, and it would really be terrible for a community. There are many great poskim who agree to this practically, and everything is because of the concern of conflict. However, nowadays, when it is known that there are different edot with different halachic rulings and minhagim, and every edah in Israel practices in accordance with its own minhagim, it is obvious there is no concern of conflict. So therefore, think about an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi, right? If you're, you know, I was at Shul just this past Shabbos, right? We daven Nusach Ashkenaz, let's say. The Sephardi walks in and starts davening Nusach Edot HaMizrach, nobody's going to say, oh my God, we have to kick him out of Shul, or oh my God, my communal rabbi is a fraud and this other guy knows what he's doing better. He's Sephardi. I know that that's what he does. And I am going to do something different, and that's okay. So when you're moving to a new location in which there's a binding sort of communal authority, that's one halacha, but that doesn't apply to marriages. Based on this, that which was said about inter-edah marriages, that a wife follows her husband to avoid conflict, the intention is not like that was mentioned in the Gemara regarding moving different places, but a weakening of peace in the home when each member of the couple behaves differently in shared matters. Right? It would be bad if we had different kasher standards in our own home. Thus, we return to our law that any matter that will not harm Shalom Bayit, a woman can continue practicing her familial customs, and he cannot force her to change her mind. However, as was stated, if she wants to change her practice to her husband's, she can ask annulment on her minhagim and have them permitted. This is an important sort of caveat at the end, right? He's not opposed to the idea of changing minhagim as long as it's done in an appropriate channel. It can happen. He does seem to think it's preferable for everyone to follow their own minhag, but there is an avenue to synthesize. Now, what's important is that for Rav Chaim David Halevi, in order for a woman to change her minhagim to her husband, she has to get a hatar and a darim. She has to annul her minhagim or annul her vows. Why? Because the change doesn't happen automatically. She needs to do it in the normal way that she would change any minhag, which is get a hatar and a darim, explain why you are no longer happy to have originally chosen to follow this minhag, and be able to make a change. You ask the Tashbetz, you would say, what do you mean you make a hatar and a darim? She became part of her husband's halachic unit. And so you don't need to make any ritual annulment. It automatically happened. There's already an interesting note, one distinction between these approaches. Obviously, the bigger difference is how much we are okay or encourage people to preserve minhagim versus to systematize. Okay, the last two approaches we'll see are two even more contemporary figures. They're all contemporary. But these are two figures who both passed away just in the past couple of years. The first is Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin. Rav Henkin is incredible. I'm a really big fan. In particular, it's worth noting that he's very much someone who comes from, we consider our world. He went to high school at Yeshiva Flatbush in Brooklyn. He studied at Columbia University, got a couple of degrees there. He's a very worldly person, and sort of not Kulo in the Beit Midrash. And he speaks to a lot of contemporary issues. I heard people call him, one of the great gedolim of modern Orthodoxy, and I think they are correct. He's definitely leading a modern Orthodox halachic and philosophical way. So he deals with our question. I give excerpts of his presentation here. So he's sort of directly engaging with Rav Moshe Feinstein, but he argues that Rav Moshe Feinstein is not only wrong in the way that Rav Chaim David Halevi thought he was wrong, namely that he's using the wrong model. The model of switching makobot is incorrect, but that's not even what's necessarily happening in marriage. The argument that a wife is considered to have moved from one place to another also requires examination, in my opinion. It appears contingent on the disagreement among the Rishonim, cited by Rosh in Ketubot and in Tur. According to Rabbeinu Tam, the rights of the wife are greater than those of her husband, and we can force him to leave his domicile and take up residence in hers, other things being equal. In such a case, the husband would ipso facto have to adopt the customs of his wife's community. He says, great, let's borrow the model of moving from one place to another. Okay, so let's look at this marriage and see who's really moving to whose place. So first of all, even in theory, Rabbeinu Tam thinks, Let's say, you know, you have a husband who lives in New York and a wife who lives in Chicago. According to Rabbeinu Tam, halachically, the wife has the right to say, great, we're married, please come move here, you have to live here with me. And that seems to happen quite a great deal in Chicago. I've known several friends who have had that exact life circumstance. Other Rishonim disagree, but it seems to be a debate. So in practice, you know, based on this debate, we do not force a wife to follow her husband or a husband to follow his wife, as Rama ruled in Eben Ezer. And usually we try to approach from a greater perspective of compromise. We should really discuss these things in the context of the shidduch process. And therefore, because there's no default that a wife automatically moves to her husband's locale, and in fact, that is itself a controversial proposition in halacha, so we can't say that a marriage is defined as a wife moving to her husband's house. That can't be the case. A woman, then, should not automatically be considered as having moved to her husband's location. And our Rav Moshe Feinstein quoted sources from the Torah, from the language of the Torah, calling a woman's place in the bayit of her husband. It's true, a woman's place is with her husband. But by the same token, a man's place is with his wife. As in the verse, therefore a man leaves his father and mother. Al-keni azov ish et aviv et imo v'nevak b'ishto. It's one of the first prakim in the Torah. And we already say that a man leaves his parents and goes to his wife. And the Torah does not discuss where a couple should live. It's dealing with the definition of marriage. And yes, it's true that a wife lives in her husband's house, but it's equally true that a husband lives in his wife's house. And so it's hard to say that one moved to the other's location. So therefore, let's get to the, you know, brass tacks, right? He pushes back on Rav Moshe Feinstein's argumentation. In matters that do not interfere with her relationship with her husband and do not constitute inui nefesh, meaning they don't impact the marriage and they're not overly afflictive, right? This is a different halacha based on halacha in the context of vows in which a husband is allowed to annul certain vows that are overly afflicting of his wife. Then she may continue to observe her previous custom. In all cases besides those, she can preserve her own menhagim, since even after she married, she could adopt them in the form of a vow that her husband would not be able to abrogate. Meaning she would be able to take on any minhag she wants anyway in the context of marriage, so she certainly can if she had them before the marriage. However, being very pragmatic, it is best that the couple reach agreement on these matters prior to the marriage. Right? Obviously, you should communicate, you should discuss, but he rejects the default assumption that a wife is joining her husband's halakhic unit or joining her husband's community. In fact, one of the sort of contemporary discussions that builds on some of the sources we've seen today is what happens when a husband is a Baal Tshuva and he marries a woman who has a strong family mesorah. So a lot of poskim will tell you that under those circumstances, the husband should really join his wife's community, right? He has, you know, whatever knowledge he has, but his wife's family has a large mesorah that he could join, and many poskim would advise him to join under those circumstances. Or if a husband marries a wife from a different community, and then they go and live near his wife's family and not near his, under those circumstances too, maybe the communal minhag should be dominant, or if not the communal minhag, maybe the minhag of the family that they're actually connected to. And so many poskim might give those leniencies in exceptional cases, even if they would generally default to the view of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I'd like to conclude, right, so just, I'll summarize now, and I have to conclude with the following source, which is just incredible, and really reflects how the Israeli context is completely different from maybe the exilic context in which many of us are operating. But just to summarize, we sort of introduce our main question and the main factors at play when it comes to husbands and wives adopting each other. Hagim. We saw that the sort of halachic default, and which seems to have been the default, though it was always unclear how well it was followed. It was like the Tashbit and the Moshe Feinstein that wives adopt their husbands min hagim. And we offered several reasons for that, whether it becomes ishto gufo, they become one unit, or because she's considered to have moved into his home. And that seemed to be the sort of generalized default. But we see some voices pushing back on that and saying, actually, we should really make these decisions contingent on the couples discussing it in advance of marriage, or perhaps like Ochaim David Halevi, really, we ought to preserve our initial minhagim. Maybe that's even better because of the, you know, strict importance of minhag. We'll conclude with the view of Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who also passed away just in the past couple of years. He was the former Rosh Yeshiva of Ma'ale Adumim. He also has a PhD in mathematics from University of Toronto. He was a Rav in the community, an educator. He was a school principal. He had a very dynamic career there as well. And before he became the Rosh Yeshiva in Ma'ale Adumim. So he's asked the same question that we've been dealing with this whole time. And he starts off by telling us how important it is to avoid conflict. sorry, to respect Minhagim, rather. We'll get to conflict in just a second. He starts with how important it's to respect Minhagim. Minhagim are really the glue that keep us connected to our own religious practices. There are some people whose primary connection to their Judaism is through their minhag and not through the sort of formal halacha. So it's very important to respect them. However, in a community of the ingathering of exiles, modern day Israel, and certainly in a marriage, in kol echad yachbid ala minhag shalo dafka, ain lacha gorein pirud yoter mizeh. Right? That would, you know what? If disgracing Minhagim would break the connection that some people have to Judaism, having conflict about Minhagim would break more people's connection. That would be terrible. Any benefit you would have is lost. All the benefit is gone. And the damage is great. Because conflict destroys any good that there is involved. Therefore, you have to be very careful in terms of how to navigate some of these issues. So we start outlining some different kinds of minhagim, and both of them are important, obviously, but ones that are more based on halacha are going to be a little bit more important, but ones that are more custom-based and not formally legal, so there's a little bit more room to be a little bit more flexible in some of those issues as they come up. Minhagim that are against halacha are very bad. You definitely shouldn't follow those. See where the key line is. Okay, so let's start from these last two short paragraphs. However, yesh rabbanim hamakbidim yoter al shmirat minhagim ha'adatiyim. There are some rabbis who are more concerned about preserving communal minhag. V'hem b'derach klal umdim al kach, she minhag ha'ba'al yikva l'chodav. And they generally adopt the principle that the minhag of the husband is determinative. It sets the bar. But I, says Rabinovich, disagree. L'fi ani yodat, yesh makom l'hakel b'derach. You can be lenient about it. Why? Kevan she'anu chayim b'tkufa shel kibbutz galiyot v'yetzira kihilot chadashot. We are in an era of ingathering of the exiles, kibbutz galiyot. We have people with all sorts of minhagim and all sorts of backgrounds making aliyah and moving to Israel and joining the same communities. And more radically, I think, Yitzirat kihilot chadashot. We're creating new communities, right? The communities that are being built in Israel are not 50% Ashkenazi, 50% Sephardi. And I'm not being precise as to the different kinds of Ashkenazi subcommunities and Sephardi subcommunities, but obviously those are relevant. But it's not like a pie chart where there's X percent of this and Y percent of that. They're being merged together, right? The process of living in the same communities, learning in the same institutions, serving in the army together, eating at the same restaurants, eating at each other's homes, davening at the same shuls, davening at each other's shul, all of these processes that happen in modern Israel are blending communities, which means that minhag is a little bit more fluid. It's not really right in modern day Israel to say that you are purely a Eastern European Polish Jew. You are, except for the little Sephardiisms that are in your minhag that you've picked up here and there, and the German thing you picked up a while back also, right? You're in a new place that isn't quite exactly the same as any formal minhag you say. The adayin lo gubshu minhagei makom. There's no such thing as a minhag makom, right? What's the minhag Beit Shemesh about a topic? Incomprehensible, because you have people in Beit Shemesh from everywhere, and everyone's doing different things. Ulefichach nitan lekvom minhagim mechadash. You could establish new minhagim. V'chol minhagei Yisrael mikol ha'edot yesh lahem ama sheyismechu. There's no such thing as a bad minhag. As long as you're doing something, you're okay. Whatever minhag you have, whatever custom you adopt, whatever rules you follow, they all have what to rely on. I just love this presentation. I'm so happy to be able to end with it because it deals with the same perspective that we saw in some of the other Israeli voices, right? Ones that respect a little bit more discretion in choosing minhagim and goes even a step further to recognize that on the reality on the ground, maybe minhagim aren't what we think they are anymore, or at least maybe we're in the process of creating new minhagim. Right. One interesting example is the Nusach Achiv, the different movements in Israel, trying to unify Nuschat. There shouldn't be Ashkenaz and Sfar and Eidot and Mizrach, Nusach Ari. There should just be the Nusach. We have to combine elements of each individual Nusach to get to that conclusion, which I think is a particularly interesting manifestation of that. Okay, like I said, not a halacha lemaisa shiur, but hopefully some interesting perspectives to take on minhagim and on the communities in which we live. I'm going to stop sharing my screen and stop the recording, but happy to stay on if anyone has questions. or wants to share some perspective.